Last time we spoke about the defense of India. General Muraguchi's megalomaniac dream of invading India was tossed into motion. Battles were raging over countless features and against formidable allied boxes, such as the Lines Box. Yet Muraguchi had relied far too heavily on seizing the allied supply depots, while promising his subordinate commanders they would have ample supplies for their tasks. Those like General Sato became so angry with their superior, they pretty much were acting insubordinate. The effort to take Kohima fully and thrust into India was falling apart battle by battle. Meanwhile, within China, General Chenault's 14th Air Force was causing major problems for the Japanese, forcing them into action. Operation Ichigo was formed. It was a colossal offensive to neutralize airfields and perhaps end the China problem once and for all. Meanwhile, the Royal Navy received some breathing room in the Mediterranean Sea, and they were now moving into the Pacific Theater. This episode is Operation Ichigo Unleashed. Welcome back to the Pacific War Podcast Week by Week, and I'm your dutiful host, Greg Watson. Before we begin, I just wanted to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I've just released part 4 and the final part to my series on General Kanji Ishiwara, Ishiwara vs. Tojo. Also, if you have a chance, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where I have exclusive podcasts. Over there, I'm releasing a two-part series on the wacky battle of Castle Itter. That is a rather strange story where Americans, Wehrmacht, and even an SS officer fought off about 150 Waffen-SS at a medieval castle. So yeah, it's a rather strange story. Come check it out. The Imperial Japanese Army, largely because of the losses incurred by the Imperial Japanese Navy, and logistical constraints, was virtually powerless to stop the Allied advance in New Guinea and through the Solomon Islands. Imperial HQ predicted further losses in early 1944, and General Douglas MacArthur was expecting to sweep up the northern New Guinea coast so he could retake the Philippines. New Guinea was thus seen as a holding operation to delay the Allied advance. With its shorter supply line, the Philippines was now being regarded as a good location to block MacArthur's advance towards the home islands. Everyone, of course, was still waiting for the decisive naval battle as well. But back on the mainland, the IJA were not dependent on the IJN. Their logistical constraints were not the same at all. Hence, suddenly in 1944, the IJA decided to unleash an incredibly large and bold offensive in Burma, northern India, and of course, in China. On New Year's Day of 1944, Chiang Kai-shek cabled President FDR, warning him that the strategy they and Stalin had agreed upon at the Tehran Conference in November of 1943, that fully emphasized the European front and was leaving China basically open to a major attack. "Before long, Japan will launch out an all-offensive against China." Yet Western intelligence disagreed with Chiang Kai-shek's sentiment. While General Stilwell was completely focused on recapturing Burma, Chiang Kai-shek's fears were about to be proven correct. In April of 1944, Operation Ichigo was launched. It was the largest military operation in Japanese history. It was also a last-ditch effort to finally solve the so-called China problem. It was obvious to the IJA the IJN were losing their maritime war in the Pacific, thus they were determined to toss the dice in China. If they were successful, overland supply lines from Burma to Korea could be secured. In addition, it would be a hell of a bargaining chip when negotiating with the Americans. If they could finally end Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang government, America would be facing the extremely formidable task of having to invade and reconquer all of China. Of course, the immediate war aims were to knock out General Chenault's air force, so he would be unable to further bomb Formosa or the home islands. Emperor Hirohito recalled in his Dokuhakuroku post-war sentiment, one shred of hope remained to bash them at Yunnan in conjunction with operations in Burma. If we did that, we could deal a telling blow to Britain and America. By early April, General Hatta had amassed 62,000 men, 52,000 of which were Japanese, and another 10,000 were collaborationist units, alongside 800 tanks, 1,550 artillery pieces, 250 aircraft, 15,550 motorized vehicles, and another 100,000 horses. This would turn into 150,000 troops, and believe it or not, it was just to be the advance guard of a campaign that would eventually involve 500,000 troops. They would be supplied with enough ammunition for 2 years. The IJ Air Forces amassed 200 bombers with enough fuel for 8 months to support them. Over the next 9 months, battles would be fought over three regions: Yunnan in central China, to the east of Nanjing; Hunan and Guangxi in south China, east of Hong Kong and Guangdong province, and south of the Yangtze River. While Ichigo was unleashed, Chiang Kai-shek's crack troops, the Y Force based out of Yunnan province, alongside Merrill's Marauders, were busy fighting alongside Stillwell in northern Burma. In spite of the efforts to keep Ichigo a secret, during early 1944, the Chinese began fortifying their defenses and redeployed troops on a large scale to strengthen their front lines. Chiang Kai-shek knew something was coming, but his commanders believed a large-scale Japanese offensive in China was impossible by this point of the war. The Japanese began carrying out a heavy bombardment campaign, targeting Hanyang, Guilin, Chongqing, and against the heavy concentration of Chinese troops advancing in the Yangtze River area. The aerial attacks greatly hampered the KMT's logistical lines. The Chinese reacted by unleashing their frontline artillery, destroying the Bawangcheng Bridge on March 25th. The Japanese went to work repairing the bridge, as Lieutenant General Uchiyama Eitaro's 12th Army would need to cross as pertaining to Operation Kogo. Kogo was the first phase of the battle aimed at opening up the Pinghan Railway that ran from Beijing to northern Wuhan. South of Beijing is the Yellow River that runs southwest to east. Uchiyama's plan was to initially cross the Yellow River to secure Zhengzhou before driving south towards the Lohe area, where the Japanese would ultimately prepare for a drive towards Liaoyang. On the night of April the 17th, the main part of the 37th Division crossed the Yellow River and advanced towards Zhangmu. The Japanese rapidly penetrated the defenders' positions, taking them by surprise. 3 kilometers in front of Zhangmu, they waited for the 7th Independent Mixed Brigade to follow up behind them. The 7th Independent Mixed Brigade had crossed the Yellow River at about the same time as the 37th Division, attacking the flank of the enemy, facing the crossing point of the main body of the brigade. Shortly after dawn, the main body of the brigade began crossing the river at a point near the left flank of the 37th Division. On the 19th, part of the 37th Division attacked Zhengzhou, completely routing the Chinese defenders, with the bulk of the division now advancing towards Lihuzhen. Meanwhile, the 110th Division advanced upon Bawangcheng, with the 62nd Division and the 9th Independent Brigade following closely behind them. The 62nd Division was accompanied by the 3rd Armored Division and the 4th Cavalry Brigade, sending out for Lohe with their tank support. The 110th Division continued their advance towards Micheonjin, capturing the town by the 24th. On the same day, the 9th Independent Brigade seized Shishuijian, but would be unable to break through the 177th Division's defenses. After a breakthrough was made at Zhengzhou, the 3rd Armored Division and the 4th Cavalry Brigade's tanks advanced past the infantry to puncture the Chinese formations, forcing a quick rout. Meanwhile, the 62nd Division, 37th Division, and 7th Brigade reached the east-west line of the Lihuzhen and prepared for an assault on Xichang. The Chinese simply were unable to respond to this. Chiang Kai-shek and his commanders assumed this was still just a punitive expedition, and that the Japanese would sooner or later turn back like they had always done in the past. As such, only the 15th and 29th armies were sent to reinforce Xuchang, to contain the Japanese offensive. Yet, on the other hand, Uchiyama had also decided to divert his tanks and cavalry northwest, preparing for a future attack against Liaoyang. On the 30th, Uchiyama's forces then began attacking Xuchang, shattering the Chinese defenses at an extreme speed, and fully occupying the city by May the 1st. The 62nd Division encountered the 15th and 29th Armies at Yingqiaozhen, battering them so heavily, the Chinese were unable to reinforce the vital railway there. two infantry battalions and one field artillery battalion of the 37th Division and the 27th Division departed Xicheng to continue marching south in order to reopen the Beijing-Hankou Railway. The North China Area Army estimated that Tang Embo would assemble his main force near Yancheng, planning to advance to Yancheng, and then they would wheel northwest in order to capture this force. However, the main force of the 31st Army Group of General Tang Engbo turned its advance to the north. The area army therefore changed its plan and decided to turn towards Liaoyang directly after the capture of Xicheng rather than wait until Yancheng was captured. Yet we are going to have to wait until next week to find out what happens next, as we are now going to be traveling back over to Burma. But don't worry, Operation Ichigo is just starting. We're going to be covering this for a very long time. After the capture of Wallabum in early March, General Stilwell ordered Merrill's Marauders to perform a wide envelopment to cut the Menang Road behind General Tanaka's 18th Division, while the 22nd Division, with tank support, drove down the Kemang Road from the north. Two Marauder battalions led by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hunter set out on March the 12th, reaching Janpan 4 days later. Once they were there, they received new orders from Stilwell to head south through the hills along the Warong Trail to make their way to Kemang to block the road at Ikangatong. Meanwhile, Merrill's 1st Battalion and the Chinese allies were facing strong enemy resistance. From their bivouac areas in the hills northeast of Shaduzup on the Kemang Road, the 1st Battalion of the 5,707th, followed by the 113th Regiment, moved out on the morning of March the 13th to put the northern clap across the Kemang Road, just south of the Jambu Bum, in the vicinity of Shaduzup. Platoons I and R followed some fresh footprints into the enemy bivouac area and stirred up the hornet's nest of Japanese. There was a brisk skirmishing, and though the Americans managed to cross the Nupia Kiga, just beyond, the Japanese had been alerted and they proceeded to delay them with expertise. Lieutenant Colonel William Osborne, commander of the 1st Battalion, decided to cut a fresh trail around the Japanese. This was painfully slow business, and they had to wait for airdrops that took another day. On March 22nd, when Colonel Hunter to the south was 1 day's march away from his goal, aggressive patrolling by Red Combat Team revealed that the Japanese had blocked every trail in the area through which Osborne had to pass. So again, Osborne elected to make his own trail, this time over some ground so rough that the mules had to be unloaded. The maneuver succeeded, and no Japanese were seen on the 23rd or the 24th of March. Osborne's march would have been greatly aided had he known Tilly's Kachin Rangers were in the same general area. But by March 22nd, they had reached Hubachi. Additionally, the 22nd Division and Colonel Brown's tanks had been hampered through the Jambu Bum, making slow progress against heavy enemy resistance because of a lack of tank infantry coordination. It was difficult to coordinate infantry and tank action because the tankers found it very hard to distinguish their countrymen from the Japanese. A few such cases of mistaken identity, and the 22nd's men were understandably reluctant to get too close to the tanks. This reminds me of a circumstance in World War I, when the IJA were laying siege to the German concession in Tsingtao. There was a small British force sent to aid the Japanese, and so much friendly firing occurred, the IJA began forcing the Brits to wear their greatcoats to distinguish them from the Germans. So you know, this kind of stuff happens. By March the 20th, Stilwell's forces crossed the ridge, reaching the Hikangla Hika, but then again, the lack of tank infantry coordination led them to pull back. Once over the Jambu Bum, the 22nd found the road down to be mined and blocked with fallen trees. 2 days were lost to clear the road, and then the three battalions made a frontal attack guiding on the road. Next day, they tried to coordinate tank infantry, with the leading tank platoon reaching the Hakakla Haka, about 4 miles south of Jambu Bum, destroying a few machine guns and taking 4 anti-tank pieces. But the infantry would not follow the tanks, and they dug in 2 miles short of the stream. The tanks patrolled till dark, and then they fell back to their own lines. Over in the east, Hunter's men departed Janpan, and then reached the Ikangangtang on March 23rd, setting up 2 roadblocks there. Hunter sent out patrols and quickly discovered Kemang was wide open, yet the delay of Stilwell's other units would force General Merrill to deny any attempts to attack south. Tanaka's reaction to the roadblocks were pretty intense. Beginning on the 24th, vigorous Japanese counterattacks followed one after another. The Morita unit, about 2 companies strong, were hastily assembled drawn up from a battalion gun platoon, an engineer company, a medical company, a divisional HQ, and were given two 75mm guns placed under the command of the 18th Division's senior adjutant, and they rushed south towards Ikangantong. Seneca also ordered the 2nd Battalion 114th Regiment over to Kemang to attack north along the Kumon Range. The attacks were so intense, Hunter's men were forced to pull back at the Mampin area by March 24th. Meanwhile, Merrill's 1st Battalion advanced to Changanhika, placing them really close to Tanaka's headquarters at Shudazup. To the north, the 64th and 66th Regiments managed to link up, but the relentless Chinese assaults continued to fail against the tenacious defenders, costing the attackers many tanks and lives. It was the 2nd Battalion 66th turn to lead on the 21st of March. Again, the tanks got well ahead of the infantry. A combination of ambush and counterattacks by the Japanese cost them 5 tanks. And then the Japanese came up around the road, almost overrunning the battalion HQ, which was only saved by the courage of 2 engineer platoons that had been clearing out the road. That night, the 1st Battalion 64th Regiment, which had been making the envelopment maneuver, came in from the east and cut off the Kemang Road, right at the segment held by the Japanese. Attack on the 23rd found Japanese anti-tank guns just south of a small stream north of the Hukanglahaka that prevented the tanks from outflanking the position. The guns knocked out the 3 leading tanks in quick succession, blocking the road. After the heavy fighting at the stream crossing, the tanks finally had to withdraw, leaving their derelicts. In the afternoon, the 2 flanking battalions made their way up the road and then they joined the 66th. Unfortunately, the meeting of the 64th and 66th Regiments did not signal the end of the Japanese resistance. Japanese and Chinese positions on the road were thoroughly intermingled, making movement in the immediate area extremely hazardous. Any attempt to break the deadlock with the tanks failed when the device chosen to identify the Chinese infantry backfired. Both the Chinese and the Japanese waved white cloths at the tanks. The armor moved into the nest of Japanese anti-tank men who destroyed 5 tanks with magnetic mines, effectively blocking the road. General Liao, the 22nd Divisional Commander, now had to cut a bypass road for the tanks around his west right flank. A tank platoon tried it, but they could not cross a ravine improperly prepared for tank crossing, and they came under heavy artillery fire and they had to withdraw. General Liao had committed his 65th Regiment to the main attack, applying immense pressure, prompting Tanaka to order his frontline regiments to withdraw 10 kilometers or so. On March 28th, Merrill's 1st Battalion established themselves along the Namkongcheng on the Japanese rear, from which they would be able to attack Tanaka's HQ. Surprised, the Japanese chose to bypass the roadblock and they evacuated their position via a track to the west. This resulted in Japanese resistance softening up somewhat, allowing the 65th Regiment to secure Shudazup by March the 29th. At the same time, Hunter's encircled marauders were fiercely resisting enemy attacks at Nifumga, with his 3rd Battalion subsequently taking up positions at the Hisamxingyang airstrip to the north. The men were extremely fatigued, facing constant marches, dysentery, malaria, and malnutrition. They fought on for 5 days under constant attack, successfully pushing back the relentless Japanese assaults. On its hilltop, the garrison, though suffering no shortage of food or ammunition, they were suffering from an acute shortage of water. There was also no plaster cast for the wounded, and they took their sulfadiazine dry. The pack animals could not be protected from the Japanese fire. When dead, their carcasses could not be buried, and the stench in the carrion flies added some misery to their battle. Sergeant Matsumoto had to play an important part at Walemum. He was the pillar of strength to the garrison, constantly scouting between the lines, overhearing Japanese conversations and informing Colonel McGee accordingly. On one occasion when Matsumoto learned of the plans to surprise a small salient at dawn, the Americans drew back their lines, booby-trapped the abandoned foxholes. Punctually, the Japanese attacked straight into the massed fire of the waiting Americans. Throwing themselves into the foxholes for cover, they set off the booby traps. Matsumoto completed the debacle by screaming charge in Japanese, causing the supporting platoon to throw themselves onto the American guns. An ailing General Merrill would be evacuated to Lido, leaving Colonel Hunter to assume formal command of the Kalad unit. He then sent his 3rd Battalion to counterattack, unsuccessfully attempting to clear the trail as the Japanese repelled all of his assaults. Finally, on April the 4th, Hunter got a breakthrough. The Japanese were believed to be moving ever more troops up the Tanai, and it was believed the 1st Battalion, which had been ordered to aid, would not arrive for 4 more days at least. Hutch's reaction was to attack on the 4th, with everyone but the sick and the mule skinners, with his large patrols called in and the Katchins used to replace them. A fake fight using carbines, which sounded like the Arisaka rifle, was staged to deceive the Japanese, and the air support made 3 passes against them. The first 2 were genuine, the last a feint which made the Japanese take cover, only to come out and find the American infantry upon them. Hunter's force gained the day and came within 1,000 yards of the besieged. At about this time, Captain John George, with a small party sent north by Hunter to find the Chinese regiment which Hunter understood would support him in this area, met the 1st Battalion, 112th Regiment, at Tanyang, about 8 miles northeast. After an interval, presumably used to obtain permission to do so, its commander moved towards Samxingyang. The 1st Element arrived at the airfield on the 4th of April and was used to guard the trail junction. Despite this increasing pressure, the Japanese made a very heavy attack on the Pumga garrison, actually reaching the foxholes at one point, but being driven out by 2 soldiers using hand grenades. For the next few days, the Marauders were reinforced by the 112th Regiment and Merrill's 1st Battalion, allowing Hunter's men to crawl closer and closer into Pumga. By Easter Sunday, the Japanese had vanished, leaving cooking fires and equipment. There was no pursuit, as Stilwell wanted no movement beyond Nufumga, and they were facing large supply issues at this time. The battalion of the 114th made its way to Mitinya, where General Tanaka, anxious about the town, added it to his garrison. The 1st Battalion, 55th Regiment, however, withdrew towards the vicinity of Barong. The Marauders had suffered 59 deaths and 314 wounded during the Ikungatam roadblock engagement and at the siege of Nufumga. The Galad unit in the 114th Regiment suffered so heavily from exhaustion, the men would be very weakened for future engagements. Now further to the south, Stuhl was concerned about the recent offensives aimed at Impal and Kohima. He was relieved somewhat when the Dirac Conference of April the 3rd, attended by Slim, Letang, Stilwell, and Mountbatten, told him that the situation was under control and that he should continue his northern offensive. During the conference, Slim also notified the others he had decided to divert the Chindits 14th and 111th Brigades further south to help out with the 4th Corps. However, Brigadiers Ferguson and Calvert argued strongly against this, not wanting to get tangled up in the battle for Impal. Calvert instead wanted to preserve White City and Broadway, whilst Ferguson wanted another attempt at Nda. The Chindits were still formally under the command of Stilwell in May, and he wanted them to hold firm at Nda to prevent the flow of Japanese reinforcements going north. It was estimated the Chindits could endure about 90 days of this action, but then they would need to pull out by mid-June. This estimation did not sit well with Stilwell. General Letang wanted to abandon the strongholds around Nda and to move closer to Stilwell's forces. Therefore, Calvert's brigade would be prepared to open the drive to the town of Mokang by attacking Monyin. Before this could occur, however, General Hayashi would initiate a general assault against the White City on the night of April the 6th. The attack began with a 3-hour artillery bombardment when the 1st and 2nd Battalions of the 4th Regiment and the 3rd Battalion of the 114th Regiment stormed Calvert's defenses. When the shelling died away, Hayashi's 3 infantry battalions attempted to punch a hole along the southeast perimeter of the stronghold, defended by the Lancashire Fusiliers, Gurkhas, and other West Africans of the 6th Nigerian Regiment. Secured behind a row of machine guns with a line of mortars behind them, the defenders opened fire. Bullets and projectiles whipped through the air, their bright flashes of tracers lending an ethereal air to the proceedings. Rounds poured into the attacking Japanese, who began to suffer very heavy casualties. Determined bands of Japanese brought up Bangalore torpedoes to destroy the wire, but they all malfunctioned. The battle went on for most of the night. The Chindits fought like lions throughout the night, and they managed to toss back numerous enemy attacks. Then, to their dismay, 27 IJA medium bombers appeared, blowing holes in the wire. The Beaufort's engaged them, shooting down about 6 and claiming another 6 probables. Desperate efforts were made to repair the defenses before the next attack came in. White City received over 100,000 yards of barbed wire and 650-foot coils of Durnet wire. The wire was 20 yards thick in places and festooned with mines and booby traps. Dakotas continued to pour reinforcements into White City. The transport planes were relegated to flights during dawn and dusk times, but they kept coming, concentrating reinforcements at White City. Fresh companies of troops materialized to take up station until, in the words of Lieutenant Dorman Durant of the South Staffords, the place was, quote, a complete babble, for it contained British troops, West Africans, Chinese, Burmans, and New Zealand RAF officers, Indians, and American Nisei, who acted as interpreters, or better said, interrogators of prisoners. Large groups of West Africans from the 7th and 12th Nigerians landed, filling out the columns and battalions, already at White City. As the planes continued to bring in reinforcements, Calvert managed to muster roughly 7 battalions in around White City against Hayashi. Over the next few nights, Calvert's defenders continued to repel Hayashi's attacks until he was finally relieved by Brigadier Abdi Ricketts' 3rd West African Brigade on April the 10th. This allowed Calvert to lead a strike force against Hayashi's HQ at Maulu from the south. While the Japanese continued their onslaught of White City, Calvert's strike force advanced to Thayang before effortlessly seizing Saipine on the 13th. Then the 7th Nigerians fell upon Maulu, prompting the HQ staff to flee south and around. With Maulu now in their hands, the Nigerians soon found themselves heavy under fire, pinned down for the next few hours under relentless Japanese firing and dive bombing by Japanese aircraft that put a surprise appearance. But soon the Gurkhas at Saipan also reported that they were under fire from the main Japanese positions at the edge of the village. The sight was inordinately beautiful and lethal. Everywhere they looked were mounds of flowering Latana shrubs, concealing hordes of Japanese infantry whose gunfire twinkled through the red, yellow, purple, and green scrub. 3 Gurkha ground attacks failed to dislodge the defenders, and the men were becoming dispirited. Calvert decided to withdraw. As dusk settled at Maulu, Vaughn began to pull his troops out of Maulu under the cover of a mortar barrage, taking with him a large collection of vital documents and an even larger trove of Japanese ceremonial swords and military equipment, which would serve as presents for the air commando and RAF air crews at White City. If anybody's interested in a rather grotesque part of the Pacific War, before I had made my channel the Pacific War Channel, it was called NBS History. I basically just did general history. But I had chose, unwisely, to do an episode on a very grotesque nature of the Pacific War, and actually even during the Vietnam War this occurred. It was the practice of taking human trophies. So as I just mentioned right now, they were taking ceremonial swords and guns and such to send home to their loved ones as gifts. Some Americans would send home human skulls, Japanese ones, that is. Sometimes it wasn't even just skulls, sometimes it was hands and other parts. Buried very far back in my channel, you can find an episode about human trophy taking. The episode covers exactly how the thing was done, how it became a huge issue for the American Postal Service, which is a little messed up, and famous instances of certain gifts coming home. There's a very famous picture of a woman who received a Japanese skull from her boyfriend. FDR famously, or allegedly I should say, received a letter opener made out of Japanese bones. And ever since the end of World War II, there's been this kind of underground effort to get some of these remains back to their families. But if you're interested in such dark nature, yeah, go over to the Pacific War Channel and just look up human trophies. Back to the story. While this was all going on, Brigadier Brodie's 14th Brigade were advancing to the Wuntho Inda Railway, where they would manage to successfully attack the main bridge close to the Bonchang Station. This interdicted the 15th Division's line of communication. To the northeast, Morris Force captured Mio Thich on April the 9th, and then continued to set up ambushes at the Bamo Lashio Road. Back over at White City, Calvert decided to try and get behind the enemy from the flanks and to hit them from the rear, pinning them against the stronghold's wire. On the night of the 16th, the Nigerians prepared an ambush at the Maluhenu Road, subsequently killing 42 Japanese. Yet realizing his striking force had trapped 2,000 Japanese, Calvert ordered his men to infiltrate forward while the West Africans at White City launched an attack. This was met by a vicious and chaotic Japanese response as Hayashi's men tried to break free. During these actions, it's estimated the Japanese suffered 700 casualties, while Calvert suffered 70 men dead, with 150 wounded. The last Japanese attack against White City occurred on April the 17th. After this, Calvert felt he could hold White City indefinitely, but Letang was concerned with the looming monsoon season, so he ordered White City and Broadway to be abandoned on May the 3rd, in favor of a new stronghold codenamed Blackpool. The site chosen for Blackpool, originally codenamed Clydeside, was a stretch of hilly ground by the railway near the village of Nam Quyen, about 32 kilometers southwest of Mogang. There was water in suitable places to build an airstrip and to deploy the 25-pounder artillery guns when they got them. Beyond a large tract of paddy was a hill which the troops christened Blackpool Hill, and it curved like a sharp-spined back of a wild boar with its head down, forearms and legs extended sideways. The Blackpool position effectively blocked the railway and the made road to Hope Inn, drawing closer to Stilwell's forces. The 11th Brigade had already been dispatched to the north to establish Blackpool. The now-rested 16th Brigade managed to capture the Indo West airfield by April the 27th, facing no opposition. Ferguson recalled, "This second attempt to Indah was an anticlimax, for these two reasons. First, just before we went in, we were told that even if we captured the airfield of the Indo West, no troops, no divisions would be available from India for flying in. All hands, the cook, it seemed, were tied up in the great battle for Manipur. We were to capture the fields for 2 or 3 days and then abandon it. Secondly, it was early apparent that the birds had flown. The Queens got right on the airfield without a shot being fired." Likewise, Letang also decided to abandon Aberdeen stronghold, evacuating Ferguson's men along with the other units. Meanwhile, by the end of April, the Joint Chiefs of Staff had also decided that the capture of Mackinac was of vital importance to the increase to the hump tonnage. This, of course, was heavily influenced by the new opportunity for land-based bombers in Chinese airfields to bomb Formosa, the Ryukyu Islands, the Philippines, and the eastern Chinese coast. Now, to capture the Mogong Mackinac area, Stilwell would receive the Ramgar-trained 30th Division, the 50th and 14th Divisions, all of which were airlifted over the hump in April. Stilwell's plan was to drive down the Mogong Valley on Kemang with such a vigor as to persuade General Tanaka that this was the principal effort. The final directive on the 23rd was for the 22nd Division to attack rather than to hold and to swing the 64th and 65th Regiments around General Tanaka's left flank, while the 66th Regiment fought down the road. Once again, the 112th was told to block off the Kemang from the south. The orders directed, "The 22nd and 38th to be at Pakrin and Lana areas by the 27th. As Stilwell would remark in his diary that day, "Now I've shot my wad." Meanwhile, the Marauder Chinese force, now codenamed Endrund, would sneak over to the Kumon Range to attack Mackinac directly. Tanaka's mission at this point was to hold Kemang with all of his strength until the rainy season, while the 53rd Division, led by Lieutenant General Kono Etsujiro, moved in to reinforce him. Elements of the 53rd Division began to sprinkle into the Indao area, but the Japanese HQ for northern Burma, from the newly activated 33rd Army led by Lieutenant General Honda Mizaki, could not decide whether to commit them towards Kemang or Mackinac. Thus, Tanaka's hopes for a counterattack were all but lost. Tanaka received two understrength regiments, the 146th and the 4th, in April and May, both of whom had suffered terrible losses against the Chindits that previous month. By mid-April, General Soon's 38th Division was assembling in front of the Tingring, with the 114th Regiment locked down in a fight with Tanaka's 55th Regiment. After a visit to Soon's command post on April the 11th, Stilwell wrote in his diary, "At least it looks like a start. The piled-up inertia is terrible." The next day, the 114th Regiment relieved the 113th on the line of three villages, all named Tigring. This move placed the 114th and 112th in line, the 112th to the east forming its lines in a smaller salient about the Nymphum Ga. The 114th Regiment was operating in a rugged terrain which was almost as much of an obstacle as the delaying positions directly about Kemang, defended so skillfully by the Japanese. On at least one occasion, the 114th lost its way and had to be located by aerial reconnaissance. The battle raged so heavily, it forced the 55th Regiment to pull back, while the 114th Regiment fought a Japanese rearguard from Hill 1725. By April the 20th, they had finally secured Tingring, and they quickly began a march south. On April the 23rd, Stilwell ordered Liao to commence the drive south from Rao Zup, with the 22nd Division trying to make their way along Tanaka's extreme left flank. The Chinese forces were advancing slowly, however, very apprehensive because Chiang Kai-shek had ordered General Sun and Liao to be as cautious as possible. Yet that is all for today on the Burma front, as we now need to jump over to New Guinea. Last time we were talking about New Guinea, General Shoghi's 239th Regiment at Madang was getting ready to cover the continued Japanese retreat to Hanza and Wewak. On the other side, General Vasey's men were in hot pursuit as always. To the east, the 58th 59th Battalion and Shoghi's 3rd Battalion were patrolling extensively in the Bongu Malomu area, playing a sort of game of hide and seek. Several patrols simply missed each other at Wenga, Barum, Damun, Rio, and the Ridu areas. But there was also several clashes. For instance, on March 26, reports from local natives and police boys indicated the Japanese were again approaching Barum, which had become the main trouble area, from the direction of Damun, just in the north. Both sides engaged one another with fire, particularly mortar bombs, but the brush was a cursory, with neither side gaining any advantage. Exchange of fire and a few sporadic attacks by the Japanese continued on for about 5 hours from 5 p.m. While Corporal Tremlin in a leading section was moving along his weapon pits with a Bren gun in his left hand and two magazines in his right, he was attacked but, not being able to bring his Bren gun into action, he bashed the Japanese over the head with his Bren magazines. The Japanese thus had the distinction of probably being the only one to be killed by a Bren magazine, rather than what was inside it. This would all last until April 11th, when the Japanese had finally withdrawn back to Madang. Over to the west, the 57th 60th Battalion departed from Quetta on April the 5th to rapidly secure Ayao. From there, they immediately sent patrols towards the Bogajin Plantation. At this point, however, General Morsehead had finally decided that it was time for Vasey's 7th Division to get some rest, so General Bose's 11th Division would assume responsibility for all the units in the Rambut Valley and the Finasteries on April the 8th. Over at Atherton, General Herring had also retired in February, so General Savage had been appointed in command of the 1st Corps. When recommending Savage's appointment, Blamey had written to the Ministry of the Army, "Two officers have been considered for this vacancy, Major General Savage and Major General Vasey. Both have been very successful in command in New Guinea operations, and I have some difficulty in determining the recommendations to be submitted, since each is capable and very worthy of advancement to higher responsibilities. Having regard to the respective careers, however, I recommend that Major General Savage be appointed." The significance of Blamey's final sentence is a matter of speculation. It could hardly refer to past careers, since Vasey's experience in command was wider than that of Berryman, a contemporary who had recently become a corps commander, and no less than Savage. Alongside this, Blamey also decided to do a changeover of Corps HQ, seeing Savage take over the 2nd Corps in the New Guinea front. On April the 10th, the 5760th then managed to break through the Japanese bridge positions to some high ground beyond the Baak, while patrols reencountered Bois and the Gori River. The attack on the 10th on the enemy position at Bridge 6, two heavily timbered spurs running down from each side of the Awori River, and making a defile, was described by Hammer as a textbook operation, and in fact, it developed perfectly. One platoon advanced down the road to fix the enemy positions, while the remainder of the company encircled the enemy position to come in from some high ground to the north. In the first encounter, the leading platoon lost two men killed and two wounded. While it engaged the enemy with fire, the rest of the company with Lieutenant Jackson's platoon in the lead clambered into position, and later that day, they clashed with the enemy in a garden area on one of the spurs. For a while, the Japanese held on, but the pressure of the Australians and the accurate fire from Private Hilberg's Bren in an exposed position in the enemy's rear forced them to withdraw. Towards dusk, an Australian patrol moved down a track towards the road where a small Japanese band was found to still be resisting with machine gun fire. The Australians did not attack, for they were sure the enemy would disappear during the night. As expected, there were no signs of Japanese the next morning. At Bridge 6, only bloody bandages and bloodstains on the track were there to remind the Australians of yesterday's fight. McCall occupied the area and sent patrols forward to Baak, the last high ground overlooking Bogajim. 2 days later, Brigadier Hammer sent strong patrols forward to Bogajim and Irima, but he found no enemy resistance in front and managed to secure both important hubs by April the 15th. At this point, while the 18th Brigade began to evacuate back to Australia, Brigadier Hammer decided to withdraw the 58th 59th Battalion and the 2 and 2nd Commando Squadron, as the 57th 60th would be the only one to continue the advance upon Madang. On April the 17th, however, General MacArthur instructed Savage that a brigade from General Ramsey's 5th Division should relieve the 32nd Division at Sador in preparation for the Hollandia-Aitipe operation, so the 8th Brigade and portions of the 30th Battalion would be flown over to Sayador in 5 days. Thus, the 300-odd troops were carried over to Bogojem as Savige ordered the 15th Brigade to rest up and for the 30th Battalion to take Madang. Hammer was anxious to get there first, so he immediately dispatched patrols to Amalie and Madang on April the 20th. Shoghi was able to fully evacuate Madang and joined his comrades as they fled to Hanza. Amalie was secured by the 24th, but the Australians would find it very difficult to cross the Gogol River afterwards. After this, the 30th Battalion and Hammer's patrols landed at Ort and resumed their advance. Both units cleared the Japanese from the Huan Peninsula before entering and abandoned Madang. During the Australian advance, an enemy mountain gun fired a dozen shells, and there was a sudden burst of machine gun fire and a couple of grenade explosions from somewhere in the Waggle area. The machine gun fire did not appear to be directed at the Australians, and the shells from the gun landed out to sea. In all probability, this was the final defiant gesture by the rearguard of the 18th Army as it left its great base at Madang, for which the Japanese had had since 1942. Madang had been heavily hit by Allied air attacks, and possibly some demolitions had been carried out by the retreating Japanese as well. The airfield was cratered and temporarily unserviceable. The harbor was littered with wrecks, but although there were two wharves very damaged, they could be repaired and Liberty ships could enter the harbor. The Australian advance through the Merkham, Ramu, and Faraya valleys was a tremendous ordeal. The 7th Division suffered between September the 18th of 1943 and April the 8th of 1944, 204 killed and 464 wounded, while it was estimated the Japanese had suffered 800 killed, 400 wounded, and 800 probably died from disease. The occupation of Madang ended the Huan Peninsula and the Ramu Valley campaigns. Meanwhile, the remainder of the 5th Division assembled at the Madang-Bogojem area, fanning out patrols to the west and sending a small detachment of the 30th Battalion to land on some small islands off the coast, preparing for a future advance against Alexshafen. Shoghi's detachment rejoined its parent division, the 41st Division, over at the Hanza area, allowing General Katagiri's 20th Division to continue their advance to Wewak. The 51st Division, who had already arrived at Wewak, got to watch the Allied air show at Hanza and Wewak as they were bombed without mercy, seeing countless barges destroyed. This would hamper Katagiri's efforts to cross the Ramu and the Sepik rivers. Meanwhile, General Nakai came across an alternate route in late April known as the Wangan Garun Uru Kluk Bien Malumburg Kop Route. This allowed the 20th Division to resume their march to Wewak. On April the 29th, a barge carrying Katagiri was intercepted by a PT boat, however. General Katagiri was killed in the engagement, leaving Nakai to assume formal command over the division. After May the 1st, the 41st Division then began to follow Nakai's route across the river, with all the Japanese units leaving Hanza by May the 15th and finally arriving to Wewak at the end of May after a 20-day movement. Meanwhile, General Adachi's plan for the coming weeks of April was for the 20th Division to immediately head towards Aitape, while the 51st Division would reinforce Hollandia once the 41st Division had reached Wewak. As such, a force was created around the 66th Regiment, led by Major General Kawakubo. They were dispatched on April the 19th, but they would fail to arrive on time, and they would have to turn back to defend Wewak. Additionally, Adachi personally sent part of his units under direct command to reinforce Hollandia. Now, after the neutralization of Hollandia and Palos, General Teramoto's remaining air units would have to move over to Manado and Ganjam on April the 15th, leaving only 25 serviceable aircraft for Major General Inada Masazumi's 6th Air Division at Hollandia. After April the 3rd, although plagued by bad weather, the 5th Air Force virtually owned the air over Hollandia. There would be only one resurgence of air opposition on April the 11th. The Japanese 14th Air Brigade staged a small fighter force to Wewak, which, despite the loss of Atoni to the 8th Fighter Squadron, shot down around 3 P-47s of the 311th Fighter Squadron, a new organization that just arrived from the United States and had only begun operations at Sayador on April the 7th. The enemy force perhaps had withdrawn to Landia by the next day, because some 20 enemy fighters pounced on a straggling B-24 there and shot it down. Aerial gunners of the 403rd Bomber Squadron claimed destruction of one of the interceptors, and the 80th Fighter Squadron claimed 8 others destroyed. In this action, Captain Richard Bong scored his 26th and 27th aerial victories, thus topping the score of 26 victories established by Rickenbacker in World War I. Promoted the same day to major, Pong was taken out of combat and returned to the United States on temporary duty at the suggestion of General Arnold, who feared adverse reaction amongst younger pilots if Pong were to be lost in combat after establishing such a record. There was also some small night attacks, combining the 5th Air Force Liberators with Navy PB-4Ys and Catalinas. They attacked the Whatcom Island during the early hours of the 6th, 13th, and 16th of April. These attacks seem to have been more profitable than similar missions against the Satani airfields, probably because Whatcom was the only small island easily identifiable by radar, and so jammed with military objectives, it made it pretty easy to hit at least one target. A captured Japanese diary recorded that on the 6th of April, a raid killed 11 men, destroyed a barracks, cratered the runways in 5 places, destroyed or severely damaged about 10 planes. A daylight attack against Whatcom by 7 squadrons of Liberators was scheduled for April the 6th, but bad weather forced its cancellation. The 24th and 41st Divisions were also carrying out their last rehearsals for Operation Reckless. Allied ground and amphibious forces had been engaged in final preparations and training for the coming assault, and on the 8th, 9th, and 10th of April, they had undertaken their last rehearsals. The 24th Division's rehearsal at Topoda Bay, on the coast of New Guinea south of Goodenough Island, was incomplete. Little unloading was attempted, and the area selected did not permit the employment of naval gunfire support. The 41st Division had a more satisfactory rehearsal with realistic unloading and naval fire near Leyte, New Guinea. The final loading began on April the 10th, with LCIs leaving their loading point 6 days later in order to allow the troops aboard to disembark at the Admiralty Islands for a day of exercising, resting, and some eating. Ships carrying the Persecution Task Force, meanwhile, moved out to Finschhafen's area on April the 18th, and on the same day they rendezvoused with the vessels bearing the 41st Division towards the Admiralties. All convoys under Admiral Barbie then moved north around the eastern side of the Admiralty Islands, and at 7 o'clock on April the 20th, the various troops assembled at the rendezvous point northwest of Manus Island. And thus, all seemed ready for the beginning of another amphibious invasion. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, if you're still hungry for some more history content, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I just released part 3 on my Japanese Invasion of Manchuria series, this one titled The Defense of Harbin. It's a much lesser known event, and honestly, almost every textbook you can find or YouTube video would just summarize the Japanese invasion of Manchuria into a single paragraph. I went through just about every single action you can. So please, show me some love, go check out the episode, and comment I'm here from the Pacific War Week by Week podcast. And also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you can find exclusive podcasts. The next exclusive podcast is going to be a two-parter on the wacky battle of Castle Itter. One of the last battles of World War II, it saw Americans, an SS officer, and some Wehrmacht fighting Waffen-SS. You heard that right. It's a very strange episode, and it's a lot of fun, so please go check it out. The Imperial Japanese Army tossed a final Hail Mary attempt to improve their war situation with the Grand Ichigo Offensive. If they could manage to seize their objectives, this would perhaps give them a better hand at the negotiating table. Because the Allies certainly would not be keen on having to liberate most of China, it was a very bold strategy.